Community Matters. Solutions to local issues and leaders who are making a positive difference.
Hey, it's Megan from The Morning Show on Your Encouraging WPER. Welcome to another edition of Community Matters. This week, we're highlighting several great pieces of information for you. Our first interview is with Lindsay Clark, Vice President of Health Education and Advocacy with the Alliance for Aging Research. And we're going to be talking this morning about Heart Valve Disease Awareness Day. So without further ado, we'll jump right in. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us today. I know our time is limited, so I'm just going to dive right in, if that's okay. So I understand you're the Vice President of Health Education and Advocacy for the Alliance for Aging Research, which that in itself is not an organization that many people are familiar with. Would you be willing just to kind of tell us a little bit about what you do overall?
Sure. Well, the Alliance for Aging Research is the leading national nonprofit organization where we work to accelerate research to enhance the experience of aging and health for all Americans. And what I do as Vice President of Health Education and Advocacy is lead efforts to educate consumers and patients and caregivers about diseases and conditions and empower them to take charge of their health.
Amazing. Thank you. And I understand Heart Valve Awareness Day, that is upon us. Can you let us know when that is?
Yes. So Heart Valve Disease Awareness Day is recognized every year on February 22nd during American Heart Month and Black History Month. And it's a day where over 100 groups and thousands of advocates come together to really raise awareness of a disease that people don't really know a whole lot about. In fact, we know that 3 out of 4 people know little to nothing about it.
I think I would absolutely include myself in that group. I don't think that it's anything that I've really had much exposure to. So how prevalent is it in our communities?
So heart valve disease affects as many as 11 million Americans are dealing with some type of heart valve disease. And what it is it's damage to one or more of the heart's 4 valves. Some types aren't serious, but others can lead to major complications, including death.
Is a lot of would one's risk be considered more of a genetic or more of a lifestyle? What has the greatest impact?
So that's a great question. So the biggest risk factor is age. So we know that 1 in 10 people are over the age of 75 are dealing with some type of moderate to severe heart valve disease. There's other things that can contribute. So people can be born with a congenital abnormality that can lead to valve disease. You can get infections of the heart that can cause it. And even radiation for some cancers can cause damage. And we do know that diabetes, high blood pressure, obesity, and heart failure can also increase the risk of heart valve disease.
So for someone who maybe has concerns about whether this is something they need to pay attention to, are there warning signs? Are there symptoms, things that they can be on the lookout in order to know, hey, I need to talk to my doctor about this?
That's really important. So they can watch for symptoms. Symptoms can include things like shortness of breath, dizziness, tightness or discomfort in the chest. They can be exceptionally tired. What's important to remember is sometimes these symptoms can be dismissed as a normal part of aging, right? Getting up the stairs is a little bit harder, or I just feel more fatigued. They might dismiss those symptoms as aging or another condition. And also people don't always have symptoms. So even with severe disease, there can be people who don't have symptoms. For that, what is important is going to your doctor. They can listen to your heart and detect an irregular heart sound or a heart murmur. And that would be the most important clue. So the bottom line is listen to your body, listen to your heart. If you feel like you have symptoms, make sure you're seeing your healthcare professional. And if you're at risk, have that conversation as well.
So in terms of at risk, are there specific groups or communities? I know that you mentioned age is one of the main risk factors, but is there anything else that could contribute to someone having a higher risk?
Well, we do know that the conditions I talked about before, like diabetes and high blood pressure, heart failure, occur at younger ages and in higher rates with Black Americans. So we know that valve disease can disproportionately impact communities of color.
How are some ways that communities can get involved? Is there anything that the public in general can do to help anything that the Alliance for Aging Research is doing?
Oh, I love that question. So for Heart Valve Disease Awareness Day, they can get involved. They can go to valvediseaseday.org to learn more about the events that we're hosting, about what we do to spread the word. We also would love that they check us out at agingresearch.org to learn about a lot of the diseases, conditions, and issues of aging that disproportionately impact older Americans and that we're working on.
And with heart disease then literally right around the corner coming up on Monday, is there still an opportunity for people to get involved this year?
Yes. So on February 22nd, we'll be hosting a virtual celebration. We'll all be enjoying the celebration from the comfort of our homes this year. But that celebration will be at 1 p.m. Eastern time. And that's a chance for folks to tune in and see all of the work that we've been doing over the past 5 years since we established the day. We'll also have a lot going on social media. We'll have a Twitter chat later in the day. And then our partners are having a lot of events on the day and then throughout the week that follows. So if anyone wants to tune in, all of the details are available at valvediseaseday.org.
Wonderful. Thank you. And any last words, anything you'd like to share before we close?
I think it's important for your listeners to remember, though, just to listen to their bodies, know their risk factors, know the symptoms, and go seek care, even in COVID, when we know that people are making decisions every day about their risk, about what they're comfortable doing. Make sure they're at least calling or having a telehealth visit with their practitioners, and if they've been diagnosed with valve disease, that they are not missing their appointment.
And for our next interview, we're going to be talking with a cancer care research expert and taking a look at how things like cancer care, cancer treatment, are still being impacted by COVID-19. Good morning. Welcome to the program. Could you just start off by introducing yourself to our listeners and a little bit about the organization that you work for, the work that you do?
My name is Dr. Richard Schilsky. I'm a medical oncologist. That's a doctor who cares for people with cancer. I'm the chief medical officer and executive vice president at the American Society of Clinical Oncology, which is the world's largest professional organization that represents physicians and others who care for people with cancer.
Perfect. Thank you. Now, I understand that there was a National Cancer Opinion Survey. Could you talk to me a little bit about what that was? What was the purpose of the survey? What information were you hoping to glean from this?
Sure. So ASCO has been conducting the National Cancer Opinion Survey now for 4 consecutive years. And we do it because we think it's important to understand what the public and people with cancer in particular expect and need from cancer research and care. It helps us better understand people's perceptions about cancer and the impact of it on their lives. This year, we focused on 3 topics in particular. Of course, the impact of COVID-19 on cancer care. We also focused on people's perceptions about the impact of race on access to health care. And thirdly, we asked questions about how people felt about participating in cancer clinical trials.
Wonderful. And would you be willing to talk us just through some highlights from the survey, some of the results that you received?
Yeah, absolutely. Let me touch on the 3 major topics. Mm-hmm. First, as it relates to COVID-19, of course, all of us have been impacted by the pandemic in many ways. Certainly, people at risk for cancer, as well as people who have cancer, have been impacted in a major way. You know, roughly at any given time, there's about a third of adults who are scheduled for some sort of cancer screening test, like a mammogram or a colonoscopy or a pap smear. And what we learned during the survey is that 2/3 of people who were scheduled to have a cancer screening test postponed or canceled the test. Most of the time, they themselves are the ones who postponed or canceled the test, although in some cases, of course, their healthcare facility just shut down and, you know, was not offering those tests during that period of time. And many people who had to go through this of postponing a scheduled screening are concerned that doing so might actually increase their chances of having a cancer not being detected in a timely fashion. So that's a big problem. Now, fortunately, you know, most healthcare facilities are safe and they're coming back online and offering full services again. And we certainly urge anyone who is scheduled for a screening or who has postponed a screening to go ahead and get that screening procedure done.
So is that one of the main concerns right now then, is just a lack of people being willing to get their screenings taken care of?
Even though people are concerned about screenings, many people are still not taking important preventive measures to reduce their risk of getting cancer. So, for example, only 48% of Americans that we spoke to report using sunblock on a regular basis to reduce their risk of getting skin cancer. Only 47% report trying to maintain a healthy weight, and only 42% report limiting their alcohol consumption. And all of these are lifestyle factors that can increase the risk of getting cancer. For people who have cancer, they are a very vulnerable population, and the pandemic has taken a significant emotional toll on those individuals. 81% of people who have cancer report having limited their contact with others because they have fears of contracting COVID-19, and that's compared with only about 60% of the general population. That includes people who don't have cancer. And 60% of people with cancer feel they've made significant sacrifices in their daily lives because of concerns about contracting COVID-19. So the pandemic is having a particular emotional toll on people who already are struggling with the emotional burden of having cancer and going through cancer treatment.
Now, on Community Matters, we've talked with other specialists within the field, and one of the topics that continually comes up is the issue of disparity in care or differences in members of our population that might be receiving different levels of care. So I guess what I want to ask is, did the research reveal any statistics that might show that race plays a role in cancer care treatment being received?
Maybe it's not surprising that a majority of Americans believe that a person's race can affect the health care they receive, and that Black and Hispanic Americans are more likely to have these views. 60% of people say that racism can impact the health care a person receives, but 76% of Blacks and 70% of Hispanics are more likely to hold those views. Blacks are also more likely than whites to believe there's unequal access to cancer care in America. And interestingly, even though people have these views and have these concerns, most people are not aware that there's actually a relationship between race and cancer survival. Less than 1 in 5 people understand that race can actually have an impact on the chances that someone will survive cancer, even though the data are very clear that particularly for Black Americans, they have the highest death rate and the shortest survival of any racial group for most cancers.
What about the advancement of cancer treatment research, which I know has a lot to do with clinical trials? Is the research that you're finding showing anything in that area being impacted?
A clinical trial is a research study. It is the primary way in which we learn about the effectiveness and safety of new cancer treatments. And of course, clinical trials have been in the news a lot lately because all the COVID vaccines are going through clinical trials. And it's the same process that we use in developing new treatments for cancer. 3 in 4 Americans say they'd be willing to participate in a clinical trial if they had cancer. But about half the people believe that patients who do participate in clinical trials are not actually receiving the best possible care and are only part of an experiment. And I want to really hasten to dispel that myth. Cancer clinical trials are always a good option for treatment for people with cancer. And if they are comparing a new treatment to another treatment, the comparison treatment is almost always whatever the current standard of care is. So if you're participating in a cancer clinical trial, you can be assured that you're going to get at least the current standard of care, and maybe something that will turn out to be better than that when the trial is finally completed. And the last thing I'll mention is that there's still a lot of myth and concern about the fact that people in clinical trials may receive a placebo. And while a placebo, of course, is an inactive form of treatment, and while in many other areas of medicine, placebo-controlled trials are the norm, that is rarely the case in cancer. We practically never use placebo controls in our trials unless, it happens to be a circumstance where there is no established standard of care that is currently available. So I want to encourage anyone who's considering participating in a cancer clinical trial to not be concerned about the possibility of receiving a placebo.
Great. Dr. Chilsky, thank you so much for your time today on Community Matters and joining us here. And now we're going to turn to our next interview for the morning, Gene Chatsky, CEO of HerMoney.com. And we'll be talking today about new research that has come out on the conundrum facing employers and employees during this pandemic. Gene, welcome to the show. Can you just kind of give me a little background on the research that has just recently been done on this?
Yeah, absolutely. So the folks at S&P Global and AARP surveyed 1,600 employees at large U.S. businesses that have 1,000 or more employees, and focused on people who are either parenting young children or providing care to an adult. And what they found was that these folks are spending far more time providing care than they did before the pandemic, and that the levels of stress have just gone up precipitously, which I imagine you might expect.
Okay, and how do you envision this sort of trend continuing, like in terms of more care being provided, more care being needed? Like, especially as we still don't know exactly where the pandemic is headed.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent question. And if you look at where we are right now in the last 6, 7, 8 months, I think we have jumped into the future several years. So take us back to last March, and we know employees were sent home, but at the same time, schools, daycares, senior centers closed down. Many have not reopened. And so that forced people into a position of having to do all of these things from home at the same time. That is still going on. And the impact on women has been disproportionate. Women already did the majority of caregiving and childcare before the pandemic. The demands on them have only increased. And as a result, what we've seen is that women have been leaving the workforce in droves. I mean, we are setting back these gains made by women over generations so quickly. In September alone, 865,000 women age 20 and older left the workforce. That's four times the number of men, and that's according to Labor Department data that was analyzed by the National Women's Law Center.
So I do think that this is something then that we've seen make headlines a lot recently, just in terms of how how women in our country are being disproportionately affected, having to leave the workplace. Have you guys discussed at all any sort of like, how do we get around this? How do we rebound back from this? Are there any solutions, or right now we just look at identifying what the situation is, and solution finding, I guess, is coming a little bit further down the road?
No, I think we're finding solutions as we go through this crisis. As a small business owner myself, I know how difficult hiring is and how it's even more difficult to hire and keep talented people in normal times, and the pandemic has just made it harder. And so we are leaning on employers to help, and there are many, many ways that employers can do this, including some that are easy and low cost. They can offer flexible hours. They can create an employee resource group. The AARP S&P Global research found that just over a third of companies, regardless of their size, have added flexible work hours to their policies since the start of the pandemic. And companies that have done this or offered flexible locations, they've had lower turnover. So those sorts of things work. We've also seen companies offering subsidized backup elder care and child care. We've seen companies more likely to offer paid parental leave policies for both men and women, although it is important to point out that these policies are typically offered to parents, but the benefits offered to family caregivers have not kept pace, and that's a really important element to focus on.
Beautiful. Thank you. I'd like to talk about family work-life balance in general? Because I think that just even outside of a pandemic, this is a really hard thing to find any sort of balance in your studies, in your experience. Any tips that you can share on how to make that a little bit more balanced?
I think you have to look at where you're spending your hours during the day. I mean, it's caregiving, it's doing your job, it's also housework and you know, taking care of things around the house. And we know that studies over time have pointed to the fact that women just do, again, a disproportionate amount of this emotional labor. And so I think the channels of communication have to be open. Talk to your spouse or your partner, if you have one, about who is taking on what task, about how you can divide and conquer in order to get everything that needs to get done in a day done without succumbing to massive amounts of stress. And again, talk to your employer. Your employer may not be aware of the challenges that you are facing at home, particularly if he or she is not facing similar challenges. So tell them what you need. Encourage them to offer the sorts of benefits that would be able to help you not only keep your job, but to do it well. Because these things are not going away. I mean, one of the things I think is so interesting is to listen to companies talk about allowing employees to continue to work from home after the pandemic is over. That means that a lot of these challenges of trying to get multiple things done at the same time will continue as well. And so we need strategies to deal with them.
Do you think that in addition to school closures and things like that, putting a greater need on needing in-home care for your kids, do you think that there's also any impact just from, like, if we take house cleaning, for example? There may be families who would rely on bringing some outside help in, even just to relieve that burden. But are you seeing anything that shows that, you know, with the pandemic, people unwilling to bring more people inside their home? So it's adding, just kind of creating this spiraling effect, a snowball effect?
So I am a focus group of one, but I can tell you that that's exactly the scenario that we've had at my house. I mean, I'm a mom. My kids are older at this point, so I'm not dealing with the challenges of remote schooling. But I've worked outside the home for decades now. I've been fortunate enough to be able to pay somebody to come in and clean the house, and I haven't been willing to do that while I'm inside the house, and so the result has been sporadic. Additional services from housekeepers, more on me and my husband in terms of cleaning and laundry and things that we hadn't done for years. And yeah, it's absolutely stressful.
Okay, so keeping open lines of communication, then that's definitely one thing that can happen or that can help within the home. You did also mention talking to employers about options. For someone who may not even know how to approach that conversation, any tips on what they can bring to their employer? Any, you know, ideas for making a case, I guess?
Yeah, I think in part it's a little bit like a negotiation about anything else with your employer. And that means leading with the fact that you love your job, that you want to be able to do your job well, that you have brought wins of various sorts to your employer. I mean, highlight the good that you've done for your employer. Highlight the good that you've done for the company. Think about if you were sitting in their chair. And then tell them what you need in order to continue to do it well. I mean, they may not realize, you know, I no longer have young kids at home. I can only imagine what it's like to have remote schooling that is taxing the band strength on my internet, as well as making it difficult to hold a meeting without interruptions, right? Explain to them what's going on so that they understand what you need, and then offer some suggestions. You know, if I could start my day earlier or finish my day later and focus on getting my children going that would enable me to do my job more effectively, or whatever it happens to be for you.
Perfect. Thank you. Well, I do know that we are just about out of time, so I just want to thank you. But real quickly, could you let us know, for people who want to know about the results of this study, where can they go for more information?
Yeah, so you can get the full report from S&P Global and AARP online at spglobal.com/somethingsgottagive. And I also want to say, for anybody in the caregiving space, AARP has been a leader in caregiving for many, many years, and there are tons of resources at aarp.org/caregiving.
Fantastic. Perfect. Well, thank you so much for your time today. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Megan.
And thank you, our audience, for joining us for another edition of Community Matters. As always, you can find audio of these interviews, if you ever want to go back and hear this information again, right on our website, WPER.org. We look forward to being with you again next week.